And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to confront a great, deeply significant anniversary. It's about 100 years. Yeah, that's right. 100 years, a full century since the beginning of World War I. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars. It didn't work out that way. And confronting the anniversary of that war, it's also an appropriate time to confront a painful question for Americans. Did we make a profound mistake by getting involved in this incredibly bloody and destructive conflict? That's the subject of this very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, World War I, the Great War or America's Greatest Mistake? The music of Over There, the unofficial battle song that sent American doughboys across the Atlantic, 2 million of them, to battle in the trenches of Europe. That song captures some of the optimistic spirit at the beginning of the war. It's a song by George M. Cohan, the great Broadway composer, the author of Grand Old Flag, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, Give My Regards to Broadway, so many hits. He wrote the song just days after Wilson had declared war on Germany, which was nearly 3 years after the war itself had begun in Europe. And some of the words of the song Over There indicate some of the problems about the decision to go to war. Because while it's very staring and over there sort of implies that Americans don't really know where they're going or why, there is no explanation anywhere in the song of what we're fighting for. In fact, the closest thing you have to declaring a purpose for the war and over there is hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Pack your little kit, show your grit, do your bit. Yankee to the ranks from the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you and the old red, white, and blue. But what exactly was there to be proud of? World War I has never been called by anyone ever the good war, the way that World War II was. It hasn't been seen by any of the participants as a necessary war, an inevitable war, a war that needed to be fought. In fact, the great British historian Paul Johnson writes, "The Great War of 1914 to 1918 was the primal tragedy of modern world civilization. The main reason why the 20th century turned into such a disastrous epic for mankind." The casualties of the war were simply staggering, unimaginable, and not just for the Europeans. In Europe and in the limited battles in Asia that occurred during World War I, total battlefield casualties were at least 10 million. 10 million. And another probably more than 10 million civilian deaths, a total of 20 million dead. And while America only entered the war very late, in fact, America only participated in the war actively because even though we declared war, it took months and months for Americans to be drafted, to be mobilized, and then to be sent across the ocean and trained and equipped. America was only involved in the war from May of 1918, actively, until November of 1918. And during that period, 117,000 young American men, our finest, 117,000 died. Believe it or not, at least 206,000 very seriously wounded. This is a devastating war. In terms of bloodshed, not even the Civil War, in terms of the amount of killing per week in the conflict, not even the Civil War could equal the bloodiness of World War I. Certainly World War II didn't. We bled and we bled and we bled. And not just human blood, but money. The expenditures in World War I, again, staggering. It is astonishing. We spent more in World War I, more than 10 times more than we did on the Civil War. That was the cost to the federal government in Washington. 10 times more than the Civil War, which lasted 4 full years and cost even more American lives in sheer numbers over those 4 years. We also spent more than twice the amount of money on World War I than the entire total operating costs of the federal government from 1789, when it was established, up until 1917. It was amazing. Our federal budget, and these figures, you can check them out. They are just hard to even imagine. But our federal budget went from less than $1 billion a year, the year that Wilson became president, 1913, to the end of the war, from $1 billion to $13 billion, inflation adjusted. We've never had a rapid expansion, both of the size of government and the amount of government spending that we did then. And, oh, yeah, how'd they pay for it? They raised taxes. Now, the income tax came in for the first time. The federal income tax permanent came in 1913, Wilson's first year as president. But the top rate for super, super rich people was 7%. The top rate by the end of the war, 77%. Okay, this was a disastrous growth in government, a disastrous growth in spending. And the amazing thing is, the American people began by not wanting it. They watched the war in Europe and they thought it was mad. They thought it was crazy. They felt themselves incredibly lucky to be in the United States and far away from the European theater. There was an editorial right at the beginning of the European War, which began in August of 1914. The Plain Dealer of Wabash, Indiana, stated, "We never appreciated so keenly as now the foresight of our fathers in emigrating from Europe." In other words, thank God we got out of that crazy place. And Jessica Tuchman, who was the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning bestseller, The Guns of August, about the origins of World War One, she wrote on the 50th anniversary of America's entry into World War One, 1967 in April, she wrote an interesting essay called How We Entered World War One. And she recalls that newspaper cartoons of the time always depicted Uncle Sam sitting and looking sort of askance over a large body of water at far-off squabbling group of little figures representing the Europeans. In one case, one of those cartoons, Uncle Sam reminds himself that the chance of his life is to, quote, sit tight, keep his hands in his pockets, and his mouth shut. In another case, they show Uncle Sam, he's standing shoulder to shoulder with President Wilson. They both have their backs turned to Europe, where there are barbarians and labeled as barbarians who are dripping blood. So how is it we went from this abhorrence to war? And the fact that war was just wildly unpopular, people, this is before the era of public opinion polling, but there were very, very few Americans who wanted us to get into the European war. How did the European war start? It started because of the breakdown of two empires in the south and the central part of Europe. The Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, which was falling apart, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And what happened is a famous assassination, June 28th of 1914. There was a visit to Bosnia, which was a province of Austro-Hungary. And it was a visit by the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, who was the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. He was going to become the emperor. And he had a pregnant wife. Both he and his wife were killed in their carriage. They were murdered. And it was fairly horrible and bloody, and the odds were against it, but they were murdered by a Serbian nationalist who wanted Serbia, which was a rising power that had been gotten its independence from the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, and it wanted Bosnia. Yeah, all these sounds familiar, right? What all of this shows is that Otto von Bismarck, who was the chancellor who built modern Germany, remember, Germany only came into existence as a country in 1871. He was once asked, will there ever be a great war in Europe? And he said, it could be. And they said, Mr. Chancellor, if there is a great war, What will start it? And he just muttered, some damn fool thing in the Balkans. That's what happened. How did the war grow out of that damn fool thing in the Balkans that Bismarck had predicted? And how is it that America, this great and peaceful nation, as Wilson described us, that America got dragged into that war? We'll talk about that and much more in this very special edition of the Michael Medved Show.
You're listening to a special show, World War One, The Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake, on The Michael Medved Show.
In 1914, Americans were listening to ragtime, like this stop-time rag by the great Scott Joplin, a great African-American ragtime composer, wildly popular at the time. And Americans were also preoccupied with baseball in the summer of 1914, including President Wilson, who was a big baseball fan. He was our first presidential full-out baseball fan. He followed baseball very closely. He, in fact, was the first president who ever got to throw out a first pitch. No one records whether it was a strike or not. But given the fact that Wilson was not particularly athletic, probably not. Meanwhile, in Europe, the powers of Europe were getting ready to blow one another up. And it's extraordinary how unmoved most Americans were by what was going on in Europe. Now, you might ask why. The truth of the matter is that many, many people look back on World War One, and they sort of read it in the context of World War II. World War II, the Allies really were fighting evil. Nazi Germany was about as close to pure evil as a nation has ever been. The militarists in Japan were certainly evil, and in terms of their mass killing of people that they occupied and their desire to build their empire through blood. Very dangerous powers. Now, none of the powers on any of the sides in World War One were like that. The European map had been reshaped very dramatically in the years leading up to the war, actually the 50 years leading up to the war. The decline of Austria-Hungary, the decline of the Ottoman Empire, had created all kinds of chaos. But meanwhile, in Central Europe, the emergence of Germany as a world power was the most important factor in European history in the last half of the 19th century. Before Bismarck brought Germany together, it had been separated into a series of smaller states, states like Sachsen and Saxony and Hesse and Bavaria, Bayern. These were all separate countries, many often with their own separate dukes and electors and crown princes. Through Blut und Eisen, blood and iron, Bismarck helped to unite Germany, and united Germany emerged as the Second German Empire in 1871. Now, this does not mean that they meant to continue conquest. They were busy consolidating. And in terms of the improvement in standard of living, no country in the world could equal what Germany was doing, except perhaps the United States of America. Great prosperity, great industrial power, great military power. And Germany came late to the game of empire in which Britain and France, and to some limited extent Belgium and Holland, were already engaged. And Germany wanted an empire of its own. None of this made war inevitable. What made war inevitable was, well, basically nothing. And there was a sense of powerlessness based upon alliances that had been formed. The assassination of the Archduke of Austria-Hungary, which was Germany's close ally, of course, they both spoke German, they were related. By the way, all the crowned heads of Europe were related. The Kaiser of Germany, the hated Kaiser Wilhelm, who became an object of intense anti-German propaganda, was actually the grandson of Queen Victoria. Yeah, really, the Queen of England was the mother of many children. One of her children was the mother of Kaiser Wilhelm. So he was first cousins with the King of England, King George V, who was on the other side of the war. He's also first cousins with Tsar Nicholas of Russia. And in fact, they had a very warm friendship, Tsar Nicholas and Kaiser Wilhelm. And there's one famous photo, and it's the most haunting thing, because literally over 5 million people died in fighting between Germany and Russia. 5 million people. And Kaiser Willy and his cousin and very good friend, Tsar Nicky, at one point they were vacationing together, and they decided to switch uniforms. And there's this famous picture of the Tsar of all the Russias, the autocrat of Russia, wearing the spiked helmet, the Pickelhaube of the Kaiser. And then you can see the Kaiser, he's wearing the Tsar's full uniform. And they were that close. So what happened that led to this war? When the Archduke was killed, the Austrians, including the aging Emperor of Austria, were very, very concerned about this Serbian nationalism that was going to upset their empire, and they wanted to punish the so-called Young Bosnia movement. And they made several demands of Serbia, saying that if Serbia didn't meet those demands, they would come in and impose them forcibly. And this was basically demands to curb back Serbian nationalism. Now, Serbia had just won two small Balkan wars in the 10 years before. So they were feeling pretty confident, and they were feeling pretty ready to resist Austria-Hungary, especially since Serbia had a commitment from Russia to support them. And Austria-Hungary had a commitment from Germany to support them. And meanwhile, Russia had a commitment from France to support them, and France had a commitment from England to support them. So the war exploded, and soon everyone mobilized. What's fascinating is to look at this heartbreaking correspondence between Nicky and Willy, the Tsar of Russia and the Kaiser of Germany, because here's what happened is the Tsar sent a telegram to his cousin. They corresponded in English because Nicky didn't speak much German and Willy didn't speak much Russian, but they both spoke English. And Nicky wrote, an ignoble war has been declared to a weak country, meaning Austria attacking Serbia. I beg you in the name of our old friendship to do what you can to stop your allies from going too far. And then the Kaiser wrote back to his cousin, I cannot consider Austria's action against Serbia an ignoble war. I therefore suggest that it would be quite possible for Russia to remain a spectator of the Austro-Serbian conflict without involving Europe in the most horrible war she has ever witnessed. They didn't hold back. They plunged forward. And the most famous comment on all of this was from the Foreign Secretary for Great Britain, Edward Grey, the first Viscount Grey of Falloden. He served as Foreign Secretary longer than anyone in British history. And as people were mobilizing at every turn and the crowds were gathering and they were cheering, he wrote this. He said, on August 3rd, we were standing at a window of my room in the Foreign Office. It was getting dusk, and the lamps were being lit in the space below on which we were looking. My friend recalls that I remarked on this with the words, the lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. Prophetic words and an incalculably bloody and destructive war. But why should it involve the United States when Americans so much resisted the idea of involvement? That story involves the strange personality of one man, Woodrow Wilson, which we get to coming up. Paul Johnson wrote of Woodrow Wilson, no more complex personality ever ruled the White House. That's a very polite British way of saying he was weird. And he was exceedingly weird. In fact, a few pages later, Paul Johnson writes about Woodrow Wilson's personality, which is crucial to understand when talking about America's lead into war. There was indeed a streak of selfish egotism in Wilson, a self-regarding arrogance and smugness masquerading as righteousness, which was always there and which grew with the exercise of power. Wilson, the good and great, was corrupted by power, and the more he had of it, the deeper the corruption bit, like acid in his soul. This was directly relevant to America getting into World War I, as was the fact that we have never had, never, a president with less leadership, less executive, less political experience than Woodrow Wilson. No, not even Barack Obama. Barack Obama has been in a lot of campaigns. He ran for the state Senate. He ran for Congress and lost. He won for the U.S. Senate. Woodrow Wilson ran for only one office in his life before the presidency. That was for governor of New Jersey. He won election. He was nominated by the Democrats within a year and a half after being elected as governor of New Jersey. Now, he had gained some fame as president of Princeton University, but he'd gained fame because he fought a lot of battles with the faculty and with the alumni, nearly all of which he lost. He was considered to be a fighting, progressive, enlightened president of Princeton, which is why he was appealing to the Democrats who wanted a reformer to run for governor of New Jersey and then eventually to run for president. This question about becoming president with so little experience, yes, less experience than Sarah Palin had when she ran for vice president. She had also been governor for less than 2 years, but she had also been mayor of Wasilla and she'd been city councilman. Wilson, nothing, nothing. So after he was president-elect and he won because the Republicans divided their votes between Teddy Roosevelt, who ran an independent progressive campaign, former president, and President Taft, who was the incumbent. When Wilson won, one of the people who had contributed a great deal to his campaign came to Wilson and said, well, I hope you appreciate what I did for you. And Wilson said, God ordained that I should be the next president of the United States. Neither you nor any other mortal or mortals could have prevented it. Ouch! This is a guy who takes himself very seriously. In fact, at the Versailles conference at the end of World War I, Georges Clemenceau, the leader of France, said of Wilson, he thinks he is another Jesus Christ come upon the earth to reform men. Look, this is problematic, and it stems from his background. His father and his grandfather on his mother's side and his wife's father and his second wife's grandfather were all Presbyterian ministers. He was deeply, deeply religious. In fact, it is recorded that when he was in the White House, he read the Bible every day. He said grace before each meal, and he got down on his knees and prayed every morning and every night. He was also an elder in the Central Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., and he often went to Wednesday evening prayer meetings. He was one of our most religious presidents, but he tended to be the chief savior of mankind in his own mind, not anyone else. Wilson grew up in the South. His first memory, he said, was of his father coming to him. His father was a Presbyterian minister and a leader of the breakaway from the Presbyterian Church because they supported slavery. Wilson's father came to him when they were living in Georgia and said, Lincoln is elected. Now there shall be war. That was Wilson's first memory. He was always sick. He never learned to read before he was 9 years old. And he was a brilliant guy. But he had all the illnesses that had him withdrawing from prep school and then going back and withdrawing again. When he started college, he had to quit because he was too sick. And then he went back to Princeton. Eventually, he got a PhD and he became a very famous professor because of his writing and his lecturing. But his seminars were always lame, which highlighted a factor about Wilson for a politician. And that was how he ultimately followed his destiny. He was very unusual because he didn't like people. He didn't like them at all. He thought they were vile. He looked down on them. He was great with a lecture, but couldn't do a seminar. He was the opposite of President Bush or President Clinton. President Clinton was good with a podium in front of him. He was good with people one-to-one. President Bush, good with people one-to-one, not so much as a speaker. Wilson? Well, his strengths and weaknesses determined the path to war. More on the way.
You're listening to a special show. World War I, the Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake on the Michael Medved Show.
When war erupted in Europe in August of 1914, Woodrow Wilson reacted the way that most Americans reacted, with horror and with fear of America somehow getting involved. His first reaction to the war was that the country must not let itself be, quote, thrown off balance by a war with which we have nothing to do, whose causes cannot touch us. So said the President of the United States, and he initially counseled his fellow countrymen to remain neutral, not only in deed, but in thought, not to favor one side or the other, with the two sides arrayed against one another, with Great Britain and France and Tsarist Russia on one side, and Germany and Austria-Hungary and Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, on the other. Part of the problem with Wilson's initial reaction to the war, and all of his biographers point this out, is he was distracted. He was distracted in the most painful way possible by the death of his wife. He adored his wife. In fact, his great friend and advisor, his chief advisor during the war years, Colonel Edward House, said he had never known a man to be so dependent on the company of women. Wilson didn't like most people. He liked women. He liked bright women. He liked women who adored him. And when his wife Ellen took sick, she had Bright's disease. She was fading, fading, fading. And ironically, she died the same week that World War I broke out in 1914. The president was inconsolable and distracted and applied himself to his work, but kept referring to his life as a burden, to his work as a burden. And meanwhile, his personal physician, Dr. Carrie Grayson, had been told in the last words of Mrs. Wilson, "You must take care of my husband after I am gone." And he had understood that to mean that the president needed another wife. He was introduced to a very handsome widow named Edith Bowling Gault. She was a direct descendant of Pocahontas. And she was, like Wilson, from the South with very strong Southern loyalties. Wilson's Southern loyalties were so strong that he was always one of those who romanticized the Confederacy. And when the movie in 1915, Birth of a Nation, the deeply racist pro-Ku Klux Klan movie by D.W. Griffith came out, Wilson had a special showing in the White House and ordered all his cabinet members to go see it. He said it was like writing history with lightning. And alas, all of it is so, so true, which probably would not be, if you take a look at that movie today, politically acceptable at all in our modern era. But President Wilson was drawn to Mrs. Gault. She had inherited a jewelry store from her late husband, which she ran. And even though it was less than 6 months after his wife had died, he became very quickly involved with the new woman who gave him a whole new lease on life. The press began to pick it up. And one Secret Service man who reputedly got into deep, deep trouble with the president and the future second Mrs. Wilson because of it, said she is a very handsome woman, but rather more plump than is the fashion today. this is not something you want to say about the future first lady of the land. And Edith Bowling Gault was not somebody to be trifled with, from the old Virginia stock that I mentioned. One thing that happened early on is the president became engaged and the country became enraged, or at least Republicans did. He was approaching a reelection. There was a chance for his reelection at the time he met the future Mrs. Wilson. And there was a great a deal of rumor mongering, none of it true, and the historians are pretty clear about this, about him having been involved with some other woman and having poisoned his wife and having gotten involved with Mrs. Gault beforehand. None of that was true. And in fact, he defied his political critics by going out in public with his new romance. And at one point they went to the theater, and the Washington Post, which was a sympathetic paper, reported on their evening at the theater, and they had a very delightful sentence. They said that in the presidential box, Mr. Wilson largely ignored the play and instead spent a delightful evening entertaining Mrs. Gault. All right, very nice. Unfortunately, there was a typographical error, or at least history says there was a typographical error. And that sentence came out in the Washington Post in their Sunday morning edition. It said, in the presidential box, Mr. Wilson largely ignored the play and spent a delightful evening entering Mrs. Gault. This was a disaster. A White House aide was the first one who spotted the typo, and he started calling all over town. Wilson was beside himself. This was ready to be a national crisis. Immediately, they sent people all around Washington to grab copies of the paper with the error into it. Wilson went to his wife and her as a fiance, and he said, I release you from the engagement. She said, don't be silly. Don't worry about it. But this was a nightmare for him. There was also a problem because an aide in the British embassy shortly after that told a joke at a dinner party. It got back to the president, and he demanded that the aide be recalled and sent home to Britain. And remember, Britain was a nation at war at this point. Relations with Britain were very important. What the aide had said at the dinner party was he had said, you know, I understand that there was a very remarkable reaction on the part of Mrs. Gault when President Wilson first proposed to her. And then everyone said, well, what was that? What was her reaction? He said, she fell out of bed. This also enraged the president. Sigmund Freud, yes, that Sigmund Freud, hated Wilson for lots of reasons. And after Wilson died, he sat down with William Bullitt, who had been an American diplomat, and he wrote a biography of Wilson in which he was trying to psychoanalyze him. This was the founder of modern psychiatry. And Freud and Bullitt wrote about Wilson's boyhood, saying, Tommy Wilson always tried to be on the side of the angels. He endeavored to think about serious matters and attempted to express his thoughts in distinguished phrases. He was so serious about himself that others took him seriously. To make fun of him was easy. To ignore him was impossible. He was a prig, but a prime prig. Just the man to take us to war. More on the way.
World War One, the Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake. MedFitHistoryStore.com.
Woodrow Wilson was serious about neutrality, and that was certainly true of his Secretary of State. His Secretary of State was William Jennings Bryan, who had three times been the Democratic nominee. He got the job largely because Wilson owed him, and owed him big time. Bryan had thrown his support to Wilson at the Democratic convention, allowing him to win a somewhat surprising nomination. And Bryan was somebody who had opposed American imperialism, opposed the imperialism that followed the Spanish-American War. He was associated as a Christian pacifist. And Wilson agreed with him that money represented the worst contraband because it commands everything else. In other words, opposing loans to any of the combatants in the war, if they were going to stay neutral, they had to avoid loans. But the problem was that this would hurt American business. William Gibbs McAdoo was one of the people in cabinet closest to Wilson, partially because he was Wilson's son-in-law. He had married Wilson's daughter. And he wrote to Wilson in August 1915, a year after the war had started in Europe, "Great prosperity is coming. It will be tremendously increased if we can extend reasonable credits to our customers. To maintain our prosperity, we must finance it." And then Robert Lansing, who was a counselor in the State Department, wrote, "If European countries cannot find means to pay, they will have to stop buying, and our present export trade will shrink proportionately. The result would be restriction of outputs, industrial depression, idle capital and idle labor, numerous failures, financial demoralization, and general unrest and suffering among the laboring classes. Oh, and yeah, and may I also add," he didn't have to add, "you're going to lose your reelection bid in 1916. So Wilson quietly, without announcing it, dropped the ban on American banks loaning to anyone who was a combatant, and basically said, okay, you can go ahead and loan to the Allies. Why not loan to the Germans? Well, because the Germans couldn't buy anything. There was a British blockade. Remember, the British Navy ruled the Atlantic Ocean, and they basically said no ships are going to be allowed to dock anywhere near Germany or any Allied countries. They were trying to starve Germany into submission in the midst of the war. So we ended up with American banks sending a great deal of money to Britain and to France in particular so that they could buy American supplies and weapons. That money, the first breach in the idea of neutrality in both thought and deed, was the beginning and crucial in drawing America into war, even though the public remained deeply, deeply opposed to it. The story of how that happened and public opinion began to shift, and how Wilson, the most unlikely of all war leaders, he was known as the schoolmaster in politics, or he could have been the preacher in politics. How did he become this great war leader who led America into a disastrous war? That and more, part of the story of what helped to produce the 20th century and 21st centuries for the greatest nation on God's green earth.